Hello there, and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 71, my favorite number. My name is David Brook. I'm your co-host. I'm here with another hostess with the mostest. His name is...
Hello, my name is Forrest with two R's. I'm excited to talk about comics. I want to make it clear that while the Four Loko incident did happen in my town, the kids were not from here. Very important statement. Very important news to get out ahead of.
I know this is old news, but and this show usually talks about new comic book news, but we were just talking about Four Loko in your town.
Yes, my town. The famous incident. What made it illegal or less cool?
Yes, they have a statue erected around this event. It's historic.
It's a gravestone, and everybody pours Four Lokos onto it.
This show is not about Four Loko. It's actually about comics. And in this week, we get to interview Gene Luen Yang about Superman Smashes the Clan, which debuts May 12th in collected format. We also talk about Shang-Chi, his upcoming Marvel Comics series that doesn't yet have a new release date since Marvel has rejiggered their schedule.
Get into all that in a second.
Yes, but before we get to Gene and the fabulous 30-minute interview I hope you hang on to listen to, we are going to get down into the brass tacks of the news. And there's some big news this week, very big news. Starting at the top, Marvel Comics, out of nowhere, tells the world we are releasing comics next week, 2 full weeks before we said we were releasing comics last week, which is why I was so shocked to see this news. And it's, but...
Yeah.
Here's the kicker, though. They're not physical. These are digital-only releases.
And they won't be.
Yes.
Yeah.
So... there are only 4 titles coming out May 13th and 4 titles coming out May 20th, but they are digital only, and they are books that were originally intended to be physical comics, it's not clear if they're ever going to release them physically, right?
I don't think that they will. Yeah. Maybe in trades. They're not going to be single issues. I would be very surprised. And also some messaging from the creators and from Marvel themselves seems to indicate that there won't be physical single issues.
Right.
I don't know, like, what the first order cutoff dates were for these. If stores now get, like, returnability on things that weren't printed and delivered, or things that were maybe printed and weren't delivered. There's obviously a lot of permutations that could happen there. And let's be honest, no shade on any of these books or any of these creators, but they're not the most exciting series.
Yeah, I don't think they were necessarily selling very well either.
No. Wednesday, May 13th is Ant-Man number 4, Avengers of the Wastelands number 4, Ghost Spider number 9. I actually like that series. Ravencroft number 4. Wednesday, May 20th has 2020 Ironheart number 1. Marvel's Spider-Man, this is the Gamerverse one, The Black Cat Strikes number 4. Hawkeye Freefall number 5. And Star number 4. So, not the most popular series. I would assume that some of the plan here is to get at least a little bit money back on what has been sunk into these books already, but I don't think that Marvel is hopeful, nor should LCSs be hopeful, that someone is going to go back and buy Hawkeye Freefall 1 through 4 because of this.
No, probably not.
I don't think that they're angling to give these series like a late-stage push, so much as they're seeking to just finish them and get some return.
What's odd is that some of these aren't necessarily the last in the run. Like Ravencroft number 5 is still going to come out at some point.
Mm.
Is it only going to be digital now, number 5?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Obviously, Marvel has released some series all digital first, and then trade second. They did so with a Jessica Jones book, and I know with a Cloak and Dagger series too.
Right.
But I don't know that they do the inverse very often.
Right. Hawkeye's done, so that's...
Yeah, this is the final issue.
Technically, like that's a way to get the story out there, which may have waited months, if not longer, if they were to get back to a regular release schedule.
Yeah.
Ironheart is a 2-part miniseries, part of the 2020 line, so that's not that big of a deal in my opinion. But yeah, some of these are going to... I mean, Zeb Wells is doing Ant-Man number 4, which I assume he's got a lot of stock to his name. But yeah, it's going to be digital only. And the surprising... I think what makes this extra surprising is that DC Comics has been releasing digital-only books, but only digital-only books that were once only giant-sized stories in the Walmart collections.
Right. Yeah, they have...
There was no intention of releasing those in small chunks like they are right now.
Right, yeah. They had an existing pool of these kind of little weirdsies to pull from, mm-hmm. and Marvel doesn't necessarily have that.
And then also DC is releasing physical books through two distributors while Diamond gets their stuff in order.
Right.
So they're actually putting out physical books every week. So it's like, to me, it feels like Marvel's trying to like, okay, DC's beaten us 2 weeks in a row with actual new books. Let's put something out so that we have something out there before we start putting out physical books on May 27th.
Yeah, I mean, they've just kind of launched a phased return to publishing, right?
Right.
By these series were obviously already done, the digital proofs, ARCs, advanced reader copies, all that stuff. They've probably been done for some time. And then it's just a matter of translating those to, you know, Comixology and that kind of stuff and delivering them that way, which is what they're doing.
Right.
And brings us to our second piece of news, which is that Marvel's bespoke digital comic shop is shutting down.
Right.
So I don't remember what the URL was, digitalcomics.marvel.com or something like that. It was called the Marvel Digital Comic Shop. They sent an email out to customers that said, hey, we're done with this. You'll be able to get books through Comixology, primarily Amazon, and I think a couple of other retailers, digital retailers, and then there will always be an archive of the books that you already own.
Right. They actually have
I have to imagine. Go ahead.
They have their own shop. It's just they're like discontinuing this other shop, this comicstore.marvel.com.
Yes, they're like Marvel based store, which I have to imagine there was like no traffic to then.
Yeah,
because it's costly for them to shut this down and archive everyone's purchases,
right?
Or redeemed codes and all that stuff. It's a big endeavor for them.
What's interesting to me, can I just say, the press release we just talked about, the one about the digital only releases, they linked to this store, this comicsstore.marvel.com, to buy the 8 issues that are coming out next 2 weeks. So it's like
the death knell. Yeah, it's like the last wave.
These are the last. If we can sell these, we're going to close it all down on June 2nd.
Right, yeah. You know, someone's hot for Ravencroft number 4.
Yeah.
They can pick it up on that digital store, but it'll be the last book they ever buy there. It probably just didn't make sense fiscally for them.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I don't know if they signed some sort of deal with Comixology or whatever. Obviously, they're still going strong with Unlimited.
I'm sure Comixology is really happy about this.
I bet they are.
I mean, even if it wasn't selling any books, it's just one less competitor, right?
Yeah.
One less way for people to get comics, which is what we all want, isn't it?
Yeah. And we've talked about this in the past. You know, they have Marvel Unlimited is kind of going up against DC Universe. Dark Horse has its own collection thing as well. But also most of those are available through Comixology.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make sense for a person to have both subscriptions. Comixology also has, I know they have like an experimental accessibility mode, guided view, the Unlimited platform, all that stuff. So it's just kind of a weird like double dipping that they're asking consumers to do.
I mean, honestly, one of the reasons why I don't dip into DC Universe that much is because I tend to just read books on Comixology. All my books are there.
Right. Yeah.
So it makes sense like... People are going to probably gravitate towards one.
I've signed up for Marvel Unlimited a couple times, and I like reading it on my iPad, but I also forget that I have it
right
very frequently, and I don't forget that I have Comixology ever.
Right.
Especially because that's tied into the Amazon ecosystem. I don't know.
Sure.
It's just more prevalent. It won, quote unquote.
Yeah, and if you ask Matthew Rosenberg, Marvel releasing Hawkeye digitally only is a win in his book. My words, not his.
He actually
took to Twitter and he commented on it because a lot of people were like pinging these creators like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. This is terrible. Comic shops won't be selling your books. And Matthew, I recommend checking out his feed here on May 6th where he talks about how this is actually a good thing. Marvel could have just canceled the book based on the sales alone, but it's still getting its due. It's still going to get out there to readers' eyeballs digitally at least. So in a sense, it's a positive thing. At least that's his tact in his chain here.
Yeah, and I think that's probably true to an extent. I'm sure they're glad that their stories are getting out there. I hope that trades are made at some point. And obviously the most affected folks are run collectors, the Wednesday Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
they're going to be upset about it. And reasonably so. If that's your thing, that's your thing. I personally, I buy floppies and then I don't read them.
Yeah, they just stack
up. I just like having them.
Yeah.
But I read my trades much more frequently.
It's just a better experience a lot of the time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
In other Marvel release news, Black Widow number one is being sent off to top retailers, quotation marks. Even though it doesn't have a release date and probably won't come out for months.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's obviously like an indication that the movie production thing just keeps on chugging.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you can't stop a marketing machine for a Marvel Studios movie, one of the biggest movies on the face of the earth and one of the most anticipated right now, even with no anticipated release date for that or the comic.
I know, I have my Black Widow Marvel Legends sitting right here from the movie that hasn't come out yet.
Yeah, so that's, it's weird. I don't know. Obviously, they have some faith in it, or at least they want... I don't know. I refer to the whole thing that they're doing right now as focus testing on Twitter.
Yeah.
They're just, like, testing digital-only releases and, like, really early movie tie-in releases and all that stuff right now, kind of in public, more so than they ever do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting from a business perspective, and it also makes sense given the circumstances.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah. But it's one of those very obvious examples of, like, the movies side of Disney and the comic side of Marvel kind of blending together and having to meet somewhere in the middle.
Right. You can't stop the engine.
You can't stop that.
You can't stop the... You can't stop
those are billion-dollar movies.
They are. Billions upon billions. Big
B. Billion.
So then DC Comics goes, oh, you want digital comics? Okay, well, we got a full release schedule for June. How about that? And so they have the entirety of June release schedule out, and it's shocking how many books are coming out each week. It's like we're back to the normal days.
Yes, it does look like normal.
Except for one,
it looks like solicits.
Very glaring thing that is different. They continue to release books on Tuesdays. And that is shocking to me.
Yeah, I said this last week.
So I thought they would switch to Wednesday when things got back to normal, because by June, Diamond will be shipping their books, but maybe not only Diamond, because right now they're shipping Tuesdays via the two other distributors that they've set up. Are they sticking to Tuesday because of these other two distributors? They prefer to ship on Tuesday or to get the books to the shops and then sold on Tuesday.
Hmm. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I'm not privy to those details, obviously, but I do think that in the... how do I want to say this? In a real person's life,
yeah,
they're going to put it on their pull list and pick it up on Wednesday.
Probably, if the other books are coming out too, yeah.
Right, yeah. If they buy anything else, I don't know. If they buy only DC, maybe they'll go into the shop on Tuesday and avoid all the other customers. They come in on a Wednesday.
Ooh, now but... DC has a premiere feel because there's not a big chug of people, right? Yeah. So back to the list, there's some biggies coming out in June. Birds of Prey number one, I know you're looking forward to that, Forrest.
That's the perennially rescheduled Brian Azzarello one, right?
Yeah, it is.
Is it?
It is, yeah.
God.
No, but some big titles include Death Metal, which is coming out June.
Oh, another one I'm looking forward
16th.
To.
I know, you can't wait for that one.
I don't want to be so negative all the time.
Joker is coming out June 9th.
God.
Which we had a preview on AIPTComics.com today over, and guess what? All right, I have to bring this up. Punchline is getting our origin story in the Joker 80th anniversary, 100-page, super spectacular. Let me just say that one more time. Punchline is getting a feature story in a Joker anniversary issue. Okay, that's all I have to say about
that. Betting big on her.
Some their regular titles are also coming out, but again, there's like 15, 20 titles a week coming out in June. So I don't know, maybe this is a sign that things are going to finally be back to normal. Oh,
I hope so.
Batman the Smile Killer is coming out Tuesday, June 23rd. That's another biggie. That's a prequel to Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino's Killer Smile, the Joker Killer Smile. You know that series?
I was trying to wrap my head around how many Joker stories there are that are being solicited. So we've got three Jokers, Joker War, Joker Killer Smile, the Joker 80th anniversary one.
Yeah.
God. But they did not resolicit or announced schedules for three Jokers yet again. So I guess we can move that one off the chart.
Oh, God. Right before the pandemic really hit. I remember the artist, I forget his name off the top of my head, Robson Rocha. He came out and was like, oh, it's coming. It's coming. It's almost, it's gonna, we're going to solicit it. It's, and then like everything stopped. It's like that book is cursed.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm excited because there's a bunch of titles in there in the list. If you go to aptcomics.com, there's a whole list of all the books coming out in June. In our next bit of news, BINC. What's it stand for? No, not the pen. The Book Industry Charitable Foundation has raised $950,000 in grants.
Which will, yeah, so yeah. I think that they actually raised more than that, but this is what they're cashing out on May 12th.
Cha-ching.
That's a lot of money. Yeah. Obviously, we talked before how much... We don't know how much money that is for an individual shop.
Right.
But this is the lump sum that they're releasing just by the end of next week. Yeah, next Tuesday.
In their press release, they said $800 to $2,400 to each of the 637 verified and qualified comic book shops across the U.S.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So that's a pretty good chunk of change. And this is also in course of thanks to Jim Lee's work with the eBay auctions he's been doing, the 60 sketches mm-hmm. in 60 yep. days.
Creators for Comics.
Yep. Oni and Lion Forge coming together. Well, Oni and Lion Forge has already come together. Oni Lion Forge also is part of that initiative. So it's more good news. That's a lot of money. I don't know if it's... I wish I knew if that was like great, good, just okay. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I have no idea
yeah.
What the realities are for a brick and mortar store owner.
I mean, if you don't have any income...
Obviously, they have to pay rent, but they also yeah. have to be paying to bring in more inventory, that kind of stuff. That's why returnability is a big deal under normal circumstances.
Right.
But I don't know. This is very awesome. I would feel great to be a store owner and see a community rally around me like this.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Regardless of the circumstances.
Oh, yeah. And more good news. Diamond Comics Distributors has come out and said, wow, we're getting lots of sales for the May 20th books. That's Steve Jeppy. That's a perfect representation of Steve Jeppy. Anyway, not a very big surprise to me. People are dying to read comics. It's been over a month now. And
yeah,
I imagine a lot of people are like, you know what? I didn't spend the usual $80 a week for 5 weeks. Now I have all this extra money to spend too.
Yeah, Steve said, the final orders you reference have been coming in better than we thought. This was on a... Comic Book News live chat with Dark Horse creator or executive Mike Richardson. We budgeted very carefully for our cash flow projections to anticipate what percentage of last year's volume for week-to-week sales, and happily those numbers are coming in stronger. The final orders he's referencing would be for the deadline May 20th, and he said, this was maybe a little ballsy, I thought, I'm going to predict to you right now that in addition to our conservative final order cutoff adjustments, these books are going to sell out, and they are going to order more.
Wow.
It's bold.
Bold move, Cotton.
Yeah, because that doesn't happen under normal circumstances.
Yeah, I'm still kind of hesitant. I mean, people, a lot of states are still locked down. It's not like people can actually get these books yet.
And obviously, Marvel spoke to that to a degree by saying, hey, the reason that we're pairing these things out or doing it in phases and not really resoliciting anything until July 15th or making a full return until July 15th is because there's a ton of regional variants.
Right. And there will be for quite some time.
Yeah. And that's obviously, it's not just... the people that deliver the comics to the LCSs, it's the LCSs being open, being able to deliver those comics to customers, customers feeling comfortable going in and picking them up, paying for them, all sorts of things.
I mean, chances are the sales are high, but they're going to be collected at the comic store and waiting for people for more than a week, if not more than that, before they pick them up, right?
Right.
So it might get to the point where LCSs are going to have to like have special storage for all the pull lists. If people want to get their books, I'm not convinced in June we're going to be back to normal.
I don't think so.
Yeah. But you know what is normal? Tom Taylor teases tons.
Oh, nice.
So I wrote
alliterative.
Thank you. I wrote a bunch of news this week based on his tweets. And by the time I reached the third tease, I was like, damn, this guy likes to tease a lot. Hate to be his wife.
Such a tease.
So First off, he teased a image of Superman carrying a small boy and I assume the boy's father in the air. And that was it. He didn't say anything else. He didn't even say who the artist was, which I thought was odd. Maybe that would have been a dead giveaway for what the book was. But It seems to suggest he's writing a traditional Superman story. This is a very Christopher Reeves looking Superman.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be happening in the deceased universe or the Injustice universe.
Yes, exactly.
Be obviously some sort of misdirect prequel. Or
it could be, otherwise. Yeah. So then the next day, he teased Deceased Dead Planet, which was actually already revealed in the June release date scheduled by DC Comics. But then he released some cover art and a variant cover as well of the new Justice League. And so this series takes place 5 years after Deceased ended.
Yes.
Sort of showing us what's happened with all the zombies.
Kind of a direct sequel series.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Obviously, all the heroes and humans have left Earth, and now for some reason they need to return.
Right.
That reason being comics.
Damian Wayne is going to be Batman, I guess. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
And if
I will say that series was much better than it had any reason to be.
Right. Yeah, it was a surprise. A surprise, to be sure, but a welcome one. I highly recommend you check out the article because I did a little side-by-side of the Blade Runner poster and then the cover art for Deceased Dead Planet, and it is a spitting image. It's kind of cool to see them side-by-side. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, they did all those horror covers for the first series, so that is really cool.
Oh my god.
They did the...
You just made me realize something. If the original was all horror covers, and this is doing...
And these are all sci-fi.
Oh, yeah. Boy. I see what they're doing. You're so smart. Because
that original series had It, The Conjuring.
Right.
A couple other ones.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah. I want to say Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I might be misremembering.
Yeah.
Maybe I made that up.
Why you always make things up? And then the last tease, which was on Friday, was Seven Secrets, which is a Boom Studios series coming out sometime this year. He revealed the logo, I assume, to the series or the team or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no details.
The logo.
Although some executives at Boom called it the Once in Future of 2020. The Kieran Gillen series, Once in Future, and Dan Mora's series, they're calling it that of 2020. So I guess... That could mean maybe it's fantasy? I don't know.
Do we have to do that?
It's every producer's like favorite thing, right?
Does thing have to be thing?
It's the Terminator of 2020.
God, yeah.
You know what?
The Neon Genesis Evangelion of X-Men comics.
I'm calling it right now. From June on, AIPT Comics Podcast is the AIPT Comics Podcast of 2021. Makes no sense. I gotta say, Tom Taylor, he's a great writer, also a great marketer. He's definitely playing the game.
Yeah, he's a workhorse.
He is.
And I know that some people levy that against him as an insult, like, oh, he's not overly creative, he's solid, but not very interesting. And I like his consistency, I like his tone. I think Deceased and Injustice are wildly different than what he was doing with, like, Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah, different.
If he is writing Superman, I'll pick it up for at least the first arc.
Sure.
He has the kind of... He's tapped into the earnestness and the humor that I want a Superman writer to have.
Yeah, a relatable character.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which Superman usually isn't, or can be not relatable.
Yeah, he can be kind of aloof and alien, right?
In our next bit of news, Humanoids is working with the Hero Initiative to pull together some money, and they're offering up digital comic bundles through May 20th for very little money. For like $2, you can get an entire bundle of number one volumes, like I Am Legion Volume 1, Metal Hurlant Volume 1 through 3. There's a lot of reading you can do for $2. For $8, you get even more, and so on and so forth. Again, Humanoids is yet another publisher stepping out there and doing some work to get comic shops open and help people.
Yes, very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice to see from someone like Humanoids who's a little bit smaller too, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt the same about like TKO.
Right, for sure.
Yeah, it's very cool.
And then also spinning out of the pandemic, Mad Cave Studios is putting out Mad Cave Showcase on May 15th. They're doing a online virtual convention one of the biggest guests that it'll be attending, has been on this very show, Chris Sabella. And he'll be interviewed on the show. So it's a 5-hour convention, digital virtual convention, starting at noon and going through to 5 p.m. They're going to have giveaways. They're going to have artists doing live drawings. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's totally cool. I actually was telling you off the air right before this that I got an email from Repop, the company behind Emerald City Comic Con, as well as some other comic conventions, C2E2, asking about if I was interested in a virtual convention, because right now Emerald City Comic Con is tentatively rescheduled for August. But I think that that is unlikely given the current status of the COVID-19 pandemic in Washington State. I think that they're starting to feel that. And the survey said, you know, like, are you interested in doing panels online? Are you interested in doing limited time merch sales online or creators access digitally, that kind of stuff? What would you like to see in a Twitter Live? What would you like to see on Instagram? So I think a lot of places are thinking about this, and that's a really great channel to still connect with fans.
You know, and all these creators are stuck inside doing nothing anyway. Mm-hmm. Put them in front of a camera. Make them shave. Furthermore, with the pandemic, Marvel is extending their free access to certain stories on their Marvel Unlimited app through June 2nd. That's a nice little cherry in your cap. Is that what they say? Cherry in your cap?
Stories, a well-known phrase.
Stories like Civil War and the Dark Phoenix saga are on there. So there are specific stories that everyone's probably read, but if you haven't, you have no excuse now.
Yeah, I think that you can get completely caught up on Venom through that now. So if you want to loop around to our first episode of our book club series.
Hell yeah.
There you go.
On June 3rd, if you have not read the Dark Phoenix saga, Forrest will go to your house and he will say strong words to your face. Calling it right now.
Yeah.
Calling it like it's a like an act of God. It's a storm, a brewing. And in our final bit of news, Image Comics has revised their June 2020 solicitations. There's a couple biggies in here, like the Nailbiter Returns number one, the sequel series by Josh Williamson and Mike Henderson, mm-hmm. November volume two, which we had Elsa Chertery on this very show to talk about. That was delayed a month. Other OGNs are coming out, like Paul is Dead, and
the second issue of Jonathan Hickman and Mike Huddleston's Decorum.
Yep.
The launch of Matt Fraction's Adventure Man.
That's interesting. Terry Dodson mm-hmm. and Rachel Dodson are drawing that one.
Gideon Falls will continue. A couple of other big series will continue. Bitterroot. Mm-hmm. They're back, baby. Or they will be back. I'm very excited for The Return of Middle West, too, by Scotty Young.
Mm.
That's a fantastic series. I like it quite a bit. I have missed it.
I'm very curious how Decorum reads, because when I finished issue one of Hickman's new series, Hickman and Mike Huddleston's new series, I was like, I kind of need to read second issue to get this, I think.
That's exactly how I felt about East of West.
And ended up being okay.
Yeah.
As you had heard in our hype every single show. This could you imagine? By the time we get to like year three of the show, we'll be like, oh yeah, he was on the show. And then he was on the show. And then everyone's gonna be like, why? Just get over yourself, dude. You know who hasn't been on the show? Warren Ellis.
Kanye West.
Kanye West and Warren Ellis. You know they're related? In our next segment, AIPT Book
Very
Club.
Very artistically similar, too.
We are going to break down Next Wave, the series by Warren Ellis and Stuart Immonen, which came out in 2006 through 2007. It was a 12-issue series. Didn't last very long. And mm-hmm. it was a series I liked a lot. I had just gotten out of college, actually, when this was coming out. And actually, I was still in college. I was still in college when this was starting to come out.
In 2006?
Yeah.
Wow. All I right.
know. I'm so old.
I was 13.
You were thinking about college.
I was thinking. No, I wasn't.
No, you weren't. So to start this segment in the book club, we talk about what is the story so far. So this is a finite series similar to other series we've talked about on the show. But this story is ridiculous. Okay, first of all, it's a comedy. It's a silly slapstick comedy. It involves superheroes you may know, like Elsa Bloodstone, Monica Rambeau, Boom Boom. But then there's also other characters that you've never heard of, like the Captain or the Captain with a swear word after it. Mm-hmm. The series is basically about giant corporations and super teams that work for them. And this one super team, Next Wave, decides they don't want to work for this corporation anymore because they work with an once evil terrorist organization. And the organization that they've stopped working for is called HATE, or the Highest Anti-Terrorism Effort, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, this series more so than others requires a suspension of disbelief, I think.
Well, yeah, in the very first issue, Fing Fang Foom shows up, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Monica Rambeau is basically the main character. She's the leader of the team, and she holds near and dear the fact that she was on the Avengers. And throughout the series, we get little snippets, flashbacks to when she was on Avengers, and it wasn't as great as she makes out to be, which is like an interesting, like very subtle character element, which you see throughout the series. It actually pokes fun at itself, the series, that there isn't a lot of character development, and they're sorry if there is. So,
yeah, it's very self-aware. It's very meta. Yeah,
exactly.
In some senses, yeah.
It's also a series that was written in two-issue arcs. Every 2 issues is a new arc. So in the first 2 issues, the team has to fight Fing Fang Foom. In the second 2 issues, so issues 3 and 4, they have to fight a giant police robot. Yes, that's right. And so on and so forth. So way over the top, silly, probably a little too edgy for the times. There's some jokes in there that uncomfortable. Certainly there are no trigger warnings in this series.
Yes, I called out a couple of things off air, and we'll talk about them in the section.
What about like the guy wearing a dress at the end? I was wondering if that was offensive. Although it was his mother's dress.
I mean, I don't think that specific issue was offensive, but the fact that you're supposed to derive humor out of that is offensive.
Like, it is his mother's dress, which makes it
less. He obviously has. But then we're getting off topic, but...
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then in that same issue, Robot Man is wearing a bra, and that's supposed to be funny.
Right, yeah.
So anyway, what worked for you? That's the next part of the segment. What works for you in Next Wave?
I really liked the characters. I liked some of the dialogue. I did find it a little one note, and we can get to that in a second, but it reminded me of the kind of slapstick, fast, self-deprecating humor of like a Guy Ritchie movie.
Oh, sure.
It reminds me a lot of like Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels, which is one of my favorite movies, or Snatch. Another fantastic movie. All of these like self-loathing, also team-hating characters on both sides, having their little asides and soliloquies and stuff. Mm-hmm. I found it very funny. I found it very relatable. I liked that it was kind of meta, and actually all of the design work is very meta. It's directly referencing Marvel not allowing some of this stuff in any other series.
Right.
I appreciated that. I appreciated that the book itself is, especially in the bookends, the beginning of the issue and the end of the issue, kind of having a conversation with you as a reader, being like, this is just dumb comics fun. You know that, right?
Right.
And it very much is. I got a deeper appreciation for it after reading, at the end of the first volume, Warren Ellis's original pitch.
Right.
Which mm-hmm. says as much.
Right. I think comics were very serious at the time. So this was a very nice departure, whereas I feel like there's more of a mix, not that there's a lot of comics right now, but in this era of comics, there seems to be more humorous comics like Deadpool, Hawkeye. They all have this sort of comedic bend, whereas back then Bendis was kind of running the show, and it was like Secret Avengers and all this stuff and all these evil organizations. So this one was like, okay, you want to see evil organizations?
Mm-hmm.
Let's make them ridiculous.
Let's name them HATE.
Right. What I liked,
I think, I think that it's rewarding in the sense that if you're aware of where comics were at the time,
sure,
you get more of the jokes that it's making. I think that's also a detriment.
Mm-hmm. But there are timeless.
But there are some very specific, very niche jokes here that I found very funny.
I loved Stuart Amon's work here. It's so angular and. At times, it's like the ships and stuff look really... It's just very stylized and cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Whereas we've seen him do very hyper-realistic stuff, especially like Star Wars or his latest series, Plunge. And here, it's a bit cartoony, which works, of course, with the humor. The female characters, like their hips literally have jagged edges. It's kind of like... It's kind of cool. I'd like to see a cartoon drawn like this. Mm-hmm. And then
it's also very colorful.
That's true. Yep.
Which I appreciated.
And Elsa Bloodstone is so awesome. Her fight scenes are like,
she kicks ass.
She literally like stands on swords while fighting samurais.
She's cool.
Yeah. And then I actually remember this being funnier. Maybe it was because I was younger. But I did laugh again a couple times while reading this.
I got an audible chuckle once per issue at least.
When you read the Fing Fang Foom introduction and it says, Mommy was a slut lizard that did the bad thing with suggestively shaped piles of nuclear waste and 9 months later. Wow.
I didn't love that.
And he absolutely has no genitals, it says.
This guy absolutely wrote Transmetropolitan, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So, and I also love the fact that it's two issue arcs. I think, you know, this was probably also a reaction to what comics were doing at the time, which was like every book was 5 or 6 issues, slowly paced, or didn't do quite as much as you probably could in 6 issues. And this was like, no, we're going to go all out and give you some action and some fun for 2 issues and, mm-hmm. And actually get some payoff in both too. Mm-hmm. There's some cool sci-fi ideas in here too. Like I like the broccoli robot men.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of some of the plot beats that might be in like Doom Patrol.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Weird absurdism.
Yeah.
Married with real world technology.
And the characters are also kind of absurd in their own ways.
Yes, absolutely.
Like Machine Man. I mean, there's a scene where he's in front of the...
His name is Aaron Stack.
Aaron Stack. Yeah, sorry. Oh, is that offensive?
No, that's a bit in the book.
Yeah, no. Oh, he's in front of the Celestials, and he thinks that he's, like, great. And they're like, you're a loser.
Yeah.
It's just and funny it's, to think
that's
of.
That's interstitched with the other team members in Next Wave calling him a loser.
Right, yeah.
Or they keep calling him a bit shit, I think, is what you're supposed to get out of it. And then it cuts to the Celestials, this big council gathered around him being like, you're a bit shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's walking away, and they're like, see, you're, like, turning your back to us right now. And
right.
He's like, well, I don't want you to know that machine men cry. And it cuts to the Celestial doing the L on his forehead.
Yeah.
It is. There's really good bits like that. And then there's some other edgy stuff that hasn't aged well at all.
It's just amazing.
That I found really off-putting.
To think of a Celestial doing something, that's like hilarious. Yeah. It's so over the top. Yeah. And then the villain, of course, is just way over the top, too. Like, there's a scene where someone chops up baby chicks and blends them, alive baby chicks, blends them, and then has them make a drink for him.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like this cliched villain, and we all know it.
Yeah, I mean, he's basically like a combination of like the main character in Fear Agent and Hunter S. Thompson and Nick Fury. Like, it's all this self-referential masculinity.
Right, stuff. Right.
Yeah.
So what did you not like?
I had never heard of this series before.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I loved it. Mm-hmm. In fact, the things that I liked were very limited. The two-arc structure is interesting from the outside looking in, but it actually makes the book, I found, very one-note.
Mm-hmm.
Because things kind of ramp up with Fin Fang Foom over the first 2 issues, and then again with a kind of Transformer to Cop over the next couple of issues, and then those kinds of plot beats just keep happening. And Dirk, the main bad guy, keeps showing up and saying these ridiculous things and degrading his soldiers and Next Wave. And it's just kind of the same pattern over and over and over.
We always see him like about to kill himself, too.
Yeah. And I really felt that it was holding for something that wasn't developing.
Mm-hmm.
If there was something that was developing in the periphery, I think it would have hooked me a little bit more.
Yeah.
But the character introductions are actually spaced very far apart.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that works, but other times I'm like, I just want to know everyone's name in the first issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not super familiar with... really, the only character I knew here is Elsa. I know who Monica Rambeau is, and I know who Machine Man is, but I just want you to give me a rundown of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
It happens, the whole book is kind of in media res, like they've been part of Next Wave, they've already left Next Wave, they're following this marketing plan from the company that now owns Hate, and I, the whole time was like, did I miss like a series leading into this?
There was the opening like synopsis Q&A that gives you a rundown of every character.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think at the time that too was kind of ahead of its time because it was self-referential and kind of silly and...
yeah,
jokey. Yeah.
And then we've obviously referenced that there was some humor, some edgier humor. Certainly of its time, edgy humor of its time that didn't really land for me. It's very Deadpool-esque. If you like that kind of humor, you'll probably like this. But there's a lot of references to sexual violence, or like a lot of references or poking fun at like queer coding. And there's like a very, it's very definitely a rape joke. Mm-hmm. I didn't love that stuff. It felt antithetical to the fun, poking fun at the seriousness of other comics at the time, mission of the book, and also of Marvel books in general. It just, it didn't land for me, mm-hmm. Aside from little moments that broke through.
The thing that really didn't work for me was the scene where Dirk is going to hang himself. Up until that point, every time we saw him attempting to kill himself, it was in such an over-the-top way that it was so silly. And just like, he had to build a giant gun with a turned barrel that would kill him, like shoot him with a, like a bullet the size of his body. But there's a scene where he is tying a, like a regular rope, and he's going to just hang himself.
Yeah.
And the joke in that scene ends up being the noises he makes while he chokes are the noises he usually makes during his alone time.
Right.
And it's like, okay, real people do kill themselves this way, and that's not very funny. But yeah, I totally get your point about the shorter arcs as well. The book reads very much like, let's just have some fun and not think too deeply about it. And that is a detriment in a sense, because it is a team book and you do want to learn about like their dynamics and stuff. And there's no real time spent on that.
Yeah. And it like, it hints at those things. Like it gives you the backstory of the captain. It gives you the moment of the Celestials with Machine Man and stuff. But those beats never really cohere into a deeper or more nuanced story.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're all just losers,
kind
right?
of there. Yeah.
So they have that in common, I suppose.
Yeah.
Also, when they flash back to Captain America telling Monica to go make him dinner,
yeah,
do you think that really happened?
I don't know. I didn't look it up.
I doubt. I mean, I don't think it ever did, but it makes you think, like, wait, is that canon now? Like,
yeah.
Oh, God. So, okay, what was your favorite artistic moment?
My favorite artistic moment is actually the cover to the second issue. It's like a old boxing or wrestling poster.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really fun font work here. It says live Gil on grill action. Fin Fang Foom versus Machine Man. Under Fin Fang Foom, it says I wear underpants. Under Machine Man's, it says my name's Aaron Stark. Next wave gets their lovin' from your mama. Not on TV. Bonus fight. Elsa Bloodstone versus Broccoli Men. It's very well designed. It's fun and irreverent. It's using jokes that were established in the first issue and that kind of carry the characters throughout the series. It's just very indicative of the ethos of the series as a whole.
Yeah,
I like when things are encapsulated in that way.
A lot of the covers were like punk in a sense. Like
edgy. Yeah, it has that feel for sure.
I tried to see like who's the cover artist. I assume it's Stuart Immonen. Because there's no like specific artist
listed.
Yeah,
I didn't see an explicit credit for that. Because I did read the Comixology version, so I don't know.
Oh, okay. The covers are like mixed media too. So mm-hmm. like it's definitely like Stuart Immonen's art on top of other stuff, but maybe he put those together. They're pretty cool.
Yeah, it's designed very well.
My favorite art in the book was a moment where Machine Man gets inside Fin Fang Foom and he like puts his arms back and like a zillion different types of blades pop out of his chest, including like nail clippers, a can opener, but also like the electric knife that you'd use on a turkey. Like it's first of all, it's insane.
I got one of those as a Christmas present last year.
Did you really? Did you use it?
Yes. No.
Yeah. That's one of those things we only use like twice in your life. Cause then you forget you even have it.
Yeah.
You're not going to use it on your ham sandwich.
It's such a specific purpose, yeah.
It's just comical how much stuff is coming out of him, but also how many different types of things he's going to use to cut at Fin Fang Foom's insides. Mm-hmm. I just thought it really worked, and visually it's just very well laid out, all these different blades. It must have been fun to draw.
Yeah, and you can definitely see how he was able to cut out Fin Fang Foom's heart with all that hardware.
Yeah, poor Fin Fang. I feel bad for him and his giant purple pants. And next up, what is your favorite narrative moment?
My favorite narrative moment is actually just a bit gag in one of the issues. I think it's the third issue. There are all these like meta title pages, or at least blurbs, in each of the issues. And this one says, "You bought an episode of Next Wave, unless you stole it from the internet." And I just appreciated that kind of irreverent, self-referential humor. Like, it's poking fun at the fact that a third of the people that read this are pirating it.
Right. Even back then in 2006. Yeah.
And that's actually an issue that I think piracy is a very serious issue. We've never talked about it at length on this show. It's something that we probably could tackle in the future, but it's something that I've noticed in particular comics creators take really seriously.
Yeah.
Like, a lot more seriously than some other mediums, especially compared to, you know, like the video game field, where people just sometimes just take the knee and put their game on Pirate Bay and then say, hey, please buy a copy of my game or whatever. That never happens with comics. And it's a very serious issue in the community, but it's also one that pretty much everyone that's in the periphery of the comics world knows about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not hard to find those websites.
No.
And so I really just appreciated that, how relevant it was to not the story, but the medium.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's having a conversation with the reader.
Right.
And that's fun. You feel catered to.
It's a comic about comics, in a sense.
Or you feel called out. I don't know.
My favorite narrative moment was in issue 3 when the characters are fighting these monsters that keep being dropped out of a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And in this scene, there are drop bears, or if you're from Australia, you'll know the koalas. And they have very big teeth, and they're falling out of the sky, and Elsa Bloodstone and Boom Boom are on the ground. Monica's like, what is happening? And Bloodstone goes, I've got two Uzis and a shovel, which I suppose means I can shoot things and bury them afterwards. Yeah. Then it cuts to the drop bears falling and their teeth wide open. And Boom Boom looks up and goes, Whittle cuddly bears of death? It's just so silly. And I don't know, over the top. It made me laugh. That issue was pretty good, too, with the broccoli robot reveal.
Yeah, and then there's, like, pterodactyl men and stuff. You know, I'll say that this book is Deadpool plus... Are we doing this in the year 2020? This is the Deadpool of Guy Ritchie movies made for people that like... what's another thing we can throw in this blender? Venture Bros.
There you go.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, because the style... Yeah.
Venture Bros by way of Guy Ritchie and Deadpool. Next Wave from Warren Ellis.
Where do we think this is going? Now, this is...
A sharp left turn from here, to be honest.
Honestly, for years, I swear to God, at least in my circles, I was one of the only people that really loved the series, but I remember seeing like people talk about like, why isn't Next Wave coming back?
Yeah, I did notice that it had a cult following. I did some research after reading it. I was surprised I'd never even heard of it.
It was, you know,
I was 13.
Yeah, and it was, yeah, that's exactly right.
I was a child.
I mean, there are chunks of time where I wasn't reading comics. I'm sure stuff happened. Or maybe everything stops when I'm not looking at it.
I don't know how to read.
When you were 13? Oh, no.
Nope.
So one point I want to make is Warren Ellis kind of takes the energy of the series, not the silliness, but like the action, character, little beats that are fun, and brought it to Secret Avengers later on when he was working with Jamie McKelvey and Matthew Wilson. That was a team of where Cap didn't have his usual costume, and he was with Beast and Black Widow and Moon Knight. And it was just like another example of like a great energy with a team that was, you know, that doesn't typically work together. And I think he sort of took what he learned something from Next Wave, probably don't be as offensive, maybe lean a little bit more into the crazy sci-fi ideas, and then mix in some offbeat characters. So I feel like if you liked Next Wave, you'll probably like his run on Secret Avengers.
I think he learned, I don't know that he learned because of his experiences with Next Wave or if it was just something else in his life, but he certainly learned to punch up through the rest of his storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Transmetropolitan obviously has a lot of that as a precursor to this, but things like Castlevania, they punch up at the church and abusers and stuff much more heavily. And then even so, the problems that are happening in the Batman's grave right now.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a much different feel, the things that Warren is rightfully angry at and expressing. And on behalf of marginalized peoples or against systems of oppression and stuff, which I think is an issue that he's very interested in talking about.
Yeah.
But that was kind of fumbled with Next Wave and has been sharpened since then.
I'd love to know what he thinks today about Next Wave.
Yeah, yeah.
I do want to know what's going on with the captain. I would not be against the captain showing up in another book.
Yeah, I think it's a character that, like, the right writer could really make work.
Yeah, because
and sometimes really good creators pick characters like that up.
And then they, like, obscurity. Make them sing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's the kind of character that you feel for a little bit. I mean, he's a bit of a loser, but he mm-hmm. wants to do good. I mean, he technically was a villain for a little while, and now he's trying to do good in Next Wave. And his powers are so basic that you could probably build off of those, too, and make them more complex.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So that's it for Book Club, folks. What are we going to talk about next week, Forrest?
Next week, we are going to be talking about the Lion Forge Press published Upgrade Soul by Ezra Clayton Daniels. This is a dozen-plus award-winning full-length graphic novel.
Nice.
That I've been meaning to read for quite some time. It's actually been on my shelf for a good while.
Talk about a left turn from Next Wave.
Yes, this book was the recipient for the 2017 Duane McDuffie Award for Diversity in Comics.
Nice. Very cool. So if you tune in next week, that will be our 7th book club.
Mm.
And soon, though, we may be retiring the book club, or maybe we should bring it back every once and again.
I think we might. Yeah, we'll see.
Maybe we'll
set up a Patreon.
Is that how you pronounce it?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure. I don't know a lot of things. But what I do know is in our next segment, Gene Lun Yang is going to be on to talk about Superman Smashes the Clan. Forrest and I came up with some fabulous questions for him.
Yeah, I was very excited to have him on.
For sure. Yeah, and we talk about not only Superman Smashes the Clan, but Super-Man. At one point, he gets a little nervous telling us why they used the dash, and there's an interesting story in there about Jim Lee. And we also talk a little bit about Shang-Chi, the upcoming Marvel comics. So yeah, I hope you enjoy. All right, on with me is Gene Lin Yang, the writer of Superman Smashes the Clan, which debuts May 12th in the collect editions. Thank you so much for being on the show, Gene.
Yeah, thank you, David. Thank you for inviting me.
So right off the bat, Superman Smashes the Clan, it's inspired by the 1940 radio drama Clan of the Fiery Cross.
That's right.
Did DC provide you with recordings of the show or transcripts? What sort of research went into dipping into this specific period of the Superman stories?
They did it, actually, but I was able to, I don't know if it's legal or not, but I definitely found all sorts of copies of this radio show all over the internet. I think it's just so popular, right? Nerds, especially comic book nerds, we remember this radio show very fondly. And this storyline, specifically because it had this real world effect. Supposedly, after all 16 episodes of the Clan of the Fiery Cross aired, the real life Ku Klux Klan experienced a drop in membership. So when people tell us that what we're doing is frivolous, why do you collect all these comics? Why do you, you know, listen to superhero stories? We can point to that and say, well, this fictional man in a red cape actually had a real world effect.
Right. And did that reaction of the Klan inspire the story in any ways?
It did. It did. I mean, one of the things is that it's one of the most important stories in the Superman mythos, right? But it's never been presented in Superman's native art form. It's never been presented as comics. It felt like a gap in comic book history, and that was something we wanted to fill.
Obviously, and unfortunately, the fight against racism is timeless, it seems. And that made this story a good candidate for adaptation right now, I think. Was there anything in the original content you intentionally excluded?
Yes, there was. and you're right. It does seem like racism is unfortunately timeless. I do think, though, that within the last few years, not just in America, but all over, there's evidence that humanity has lost our faith in our ability to live with people who are different from us. And it's not just in America. You know, I see it when I read news about what's happening in the Philippines and in India and in different places in Europe. It's a little distressing to see, to be honest. Ooh, I'm sorry, what was that question again? I kind of got off on a tangent.
No, tangents are good. Was there anything in the original content you intentionally excluded?
There's a character named Poco who is an alien. who ends up serving as Perry White's cook.
Oh, wow.
He has a role in, and I think he talks in a really weird way. It's been a while since I listened to those original radio shows. I think he talks in rhymes or something, but anyways, we left him out. He's like a really goofy character that never made it, made the jump from the radio show to the comics. He's so goofy. Like Superman has had some goofy characters, but Poco's so goofy that he did not make that jump. Like, you know, Perry White, Jimmy Olsen, Kryptonite, they all made the jump. Poco did not. So we left him out. There are also other plot elements that didn't quite work for a modern audience. For instance, one of the episodes ends with Perry White and Jimmy Olsen about to get tarred and feathered by the Klan. And then it cuts, right? That's the cliffhanger.
Right. Yeah.
At the beginning of the next episode, the Klan's like, who forgot the tar? You know? And that kind of thing just not gonna work. It's not gonna work for a modern audience.
I have to say, I got an early copy to look at of the collected edition, and it reads so well collected, almost as if there were no single issue formats to it. When you were writing this, was that at all something that you wanted to make like as a cohesive read through? When you were approaching the plotting? Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. I approached it as a graphic novel. I approached it as a 3-chapter graphic novel, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful that DC decided to put it out as individual issues. We did it for a bunch of different reasons. One of which is we wanted to support the direct market. But when I was thinking about the plot and when I was outlining it, I definitely outlined all 3 chapters at once.
What do you think is the quintessential Superman story? And do you have a favorite?
I don't know. I mean, I think that origin story has been told over and over and over again. And it's so familiar that it's become almost like our mythology, right? It's American mythology. Everybody knows the Superman origin story. In terms of favorites, I really like Birthright. I'm a big Mark Waid fan. And then Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow is also a favorite of mine.
Yeah.
I really like the Bendis run as well. I'm not caught up on it, but the pieces I've read so far, I've really enjoyed.
It's funny, you mentioned mythology. You know how like we dig up ruins in Athens and we find these, you know, effigies of Zeus or whatever. In 300 years, will someone dig up Superman Smashes the Klan and be like, what? Wow, this is this was their culture. And they try to understand who we are.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to dig up Superman for sure, right? Something with Superman on it is going to show up.
That's true.
Even if our civilization collapses and they're going to wonder what he means. I think that's definitely going to happen.
Yeah, probably will, especially with all the plastic.
Yeah. I also wonder what, I mean, it's going to be Superman and Batman, probably Wonder Woman too, all 3 of them. And I wonder what the interpretation is going to be.
Well, let's just hope they don't find like the bad, I mean, in my opinion, like Batman, Superman, the movie.
Yeah.
I hope they don't find a copy of that because then, you know, they might misunderstand the whole point of the characters.
Yeah.
Martha! Sorry. Okay, so first of all, I love the concept of the Boy Scout. I was reading another interview you did, I forget where exactly, where you were talking about how Superman's wearing bright clothes and, you know, he considers himself a Boy Scout because he's trying to, you know, be the best he can be to set an example. And I think in the interview you mentioned your own family. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm the son of immigrants. My mom was born in mainland China, my dad in Taiwan. They both came to the United States for graduate school. And this is something that I noticed about them as I was growing up. I think my parents are rule followers. They don't like breaking rules. They like to try to figure out what the unspoken conventions and rules are and follow them, you know. And as a kid, I just thought there were these big squares. I couldn't understand why they would act like that, you know. But eventually I realized that the reason why they do that is because they're immigrants. They have this inherent feeling of being outsiders. They really want to be included. And the way they get people to not question their citizenship is by trying to be the most perfect citizens that they can be. My interpretation of Superman is also an immigrant. He comes from even farther than China. He comes from a different planet. And he's also perceived as this perfect Boy Scout. I think at least the way I read him is he's doing it for the same reasons. He tries to be the perfect citizen so that nobody will question his citizenship.
That's such a fascinating idea that I don't think I've ever seen before. And I mean, given today's politics in America and like the news literally today about closing the borders from immigrants, good Lord, this book feels more pertinent and important for people to read than ever.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I do think, though, that, you know, Superman,
yeah.
he was created by these two children of immigrants, right? Both mm-hmm. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were right. the children of Jewish immigrants from Europe. And I don't know if they meant to do it. I don't know if it was like top of their mind as they were creating this character. But I do think it's just baked into who he is, right? He has these mm-hmm. two different identities. Has to navigate between these two different cultures. He has to go through this whole period where he discovers his heritage. You know, mm-hmm. that's almost in every... That's version yeah. of Superman. So it's always been there. It's always been in this.
I was curious about the costume. Specifically, there's actually black in the symbol. And I was trying to find an answer to it across the webs, but I couldn't. Was there a reason for the black in the symbol?
The real simple reason is we wanted it to feel like the 1940s. So in the 1940s, okay. the Fleischer Studio Superman cartoons were pretty prominent. They were... I mean, even now they're considered classic cartoons, right?
Yeah.
And I think he had black in his S insignia.
Oh, gotcha.
In those cartoons.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also think, I mean, just aesthetically, I really like that look. Mm. I think it's just really cool looking. You know?
It really is. Yeah. I love this idea that he thinks he's a Boy Scout because it's almost like even if it's subconscious, it means, you know, society itself is. Forcing him to act a certain way or be a certain way, not necessarily because, you know, he wants to be. And that creates like a psychological aspect that I just didn't see coming when reading the book.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think, like I said, I do think it's inherent in a lot of other Superman stories, you know, mm-hmm. even if it's not explicitly said, it's in the subtext.
Speaking of Super-Man, might you know when we might see Kong Kanan back in the DC Comics?
Well, thanks for asking. I had so much fun working on New Superman. I have to say, at the very beginning of the project, you know, when they first asked me,
yeah.
I was very reluctant to say yes. And I was reluctant for all sorts of reasons. Like they called me up and they're like, hey, we got this idea. We're going to make like a Chinese version of Superman. What do you think? And I said, Chinese American? And they said, no, Chinese in China. And then I was like, that sounds like a terrible idea. I don't want anything to do with that. You know, I was really freaked out in part because of my own personal history. So
right.
my parents, my mom, you know, yeah. She was born in mainland China. And the reason why we're Chinese American in part is because her dad worked for the National Government, which was the government that was in power before the Communist Party.
Oh.
So I grew up with some really
interesting,
intense views about politics in China.
Yeah.
And now I know it's more nuanced today than I was led to believe as a kid, or even as it actually was when I was a kid. But I still thought, man, like Superman's supposed to be about truth and justice in the American way. What does that mean
right,
in modern China? But in the end, I did it because Jim Lee called me into his office and he's like, this was my idea. I wanted an Asian member of the Superman family, you know, and I'm a huge Jim Lee fan.
Yeah. How do you say no to Jim Lee?
Yeah. Right. How do you say no to the guy who did all those 90s X-Men? So I did it. And it ended up being like a ton of fun, way more fun than I thought it was going to be for sure.
Was the dash yeah. always part of the name?
Yeah. I think that dash was Jeff Johns. Idea.
Oh, okay.
And it's because in some early Superman comics he has that dash in there.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? So do you think superheroes should have the dash like Spider-Man? Or do you think they should not have the dash?
You could probably dig up some of my reviews of the first few issues. I probably mentioned, but this belongs to Spider-Man for some reason. It's tricky because it's such an iconic element of Spider-Man's name that it immediately made me think of that character for some reason. But now that you mentioned that it's part of like the history of the naming, I mean, it makes so much sense in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the original title, I hope nobody minds me telling you this, but the original title of the series was going to be The Superman.
Okay.
And because that's the way, you know, Clark Kent Superman was referred to in some early
stories.
Superman.
Yeah, it's almost like he's an entity or something.
To new. Yeah.
It's like a force. Like you don't even know what it is. That's actually kind of interesting. That would have put an interesting spin on it. I think DC messed up. I don't know. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, okay. So the reason why we changed it from to new is because in China, there's no, like in Chinese, there's no real the
yeah yeah
there's no equivalent to that.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
So it would have made the translation a little weird.
How was it received in China? Do you know?
You know, I've heard from Chinese readers.
Yeah.
And some of them have been really positive. They've really liked it. And others have said, well, it reads like it was written by a Chinese American. And I'm not going to argue with that. I'm sure it reads like it was written by a Chinese American.
That's funny. How does your process differ writing for different publishers and established properties versus, say, creator-owned projects?
Well, with my creator-owned projects, it depends on whether I'm drawing it or not. Mm-hmm. Usually, even if I'm not drawing it, I'll write in thumbnails. So I'll do sketches of what every page looks like in the book, you know, and I won't do a script at all. But for my work for Dark Horse on those Avatar comics and for DC, I turn in comic book scripts. Okay. That's the biggest difference. Yeah, that's the biggest difference. I guess the other difference is I have to have like a certain level of trust, you know, because when I'm drawing it myself, I have control over every single line that goes on that page. But with work that I'm doing with another artist, I have to have a certain level of trust. And honestly, for the most part, like every single artist I've worked with has been awesome. So far, at least, you know, they've just been so talented. And I think that that the blend, it ends up being like this blend of storytelling voices, right? And the blend is always better than I expected it to be. So I've just been really lucky. Like for Superman Smashes the Clan, there's just no way I would have been able to pull off that story with my limited drawing skill. They're amazing.
Does the writer in you, an artist in you, you know, look at Superman Smashes the Clan and be like, I want to see my version drawn.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, like in the final scene, it takes place at a baseball game. And I just, when I was writing that scene, you know, I was like, I was writing about the crowds. I was like, man, Guru's going to hate me for this scene. I did another book recently that I drew myself. It's about basketball, so lots of crowds in that as well.
Yeah.
And my artist self really hated my writer self for all those crowd scenes.
That's funny. It was such a pain. Now I'm wondering, does that influence you, that the artist inside you're like, no, don't make them draw all this, you know, the webs on Spider-Man's costume or whatever.
Well, I feel bad. I feel bad about drawing or writing in scenes that are complex to draw, but I don't feel so bad that I'll leave them out.
That makes sense. I'll still put them in. You're an artist. You, the heart wants what the heart wants.
That's right. The heart wants what the heart wants.
This leads right into my next question. What one artist that you haven't worked with before do you most want to work with?
I would love to work with Jen Wang. Are you familiar with her work?
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
She did a book called, I don't know if she's done anything for the big two superhero companies, but she does mostly graphic novels. She did a book called The Princess and the Dressmaker.
Okay.
That got a lot of buzz. And she's done another one called Coco Be Good, a bunch of other stuff. She's great. She's great. Yeah. Oh, she did Stargazing, a middle grade book that came out recently. It also got some awards attention. But I want to work with her in part because I really admire her art, and also in part because I would love to see our names on the cover. I think it'd just be so funny, right? To have Gene Yang and Jen Wang on the same cover.
I mean, whoever lays out the cover art and the names on the cover art, you have to be in that meeting, I think.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
That's actually an interesting question. Are you ever involved in, you know, where the title might go or anything like that?
Well, I actually have a really terrible design sense. There are certain things in comics that I'm just not good at. I'm not good at color, and I'm not good at cover designs at all. So I, like with the cover design for Superman Smashes the Clan, I thought it turned out great. The yellow cover, you know, with the...
Oh, yeah. It's so striking.
Corner. Yeah, it really stands out, I think. But I feel like I had minimal feedback on that. There are people who know covers better than me who really worked on that. And I think they did a great job.
That makes sense. What did you want to be when you were little?
When I was really little, I wanted to be an animator. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a Disney animator. I wanted to work for Disney and work on movies and cartoons. And then in fifth grade, that all changed because I got a Superman comic, actually. My mom bought me a Superman comic off of a spinner rack at my local bookstore. And from then on, I was sort of torn. I knew I wanted to tell stories through drawing, but I didn't know if I wanted to do it as an animator, as a comic book artists. So I chose comic book artists, and I'm happy with that choice. But then I do have friends in animation, and they have things like healthcare, which is awesome.
Oh, jeez, insurance. Oh, for sure. Unionize. Yeah, you need to unionize.
I know, right? Like they and they get regular paychecks, and so there are definitely benefits to both routes.
I mean, you keep moving around publishers, writing different characters. You could end up, in an animation studio, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Like I look at what my friends in animation do, and some of it just seems so hard.
Yeah.
You can tell. Like, you can tell when somebody goes from animation to comics. There are these two guys, they do a book called Giants Beware, mm-hmm. and they're so fast. Mm. People who start off in comics are just not that fast, right? And in animation, just because of the way the workflow goes, they draw so quickly and so well.
It's interesting. I do some animation for my day job. I work for a pre-K and K nonprofit, and I animate and narrate as a Badger cartoon. And I can say with certainty, it takes a kind of mathematical mind to animate versus design, like drawing or just setting up like a cover or a page like that. I don't, maybe that's the trouble between like a, crossing over from comics to animation, because, drawing and writing is one thing, but is that the mathematical mind? I'm not so sure.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, how long does it take you to do an animation project?
A minute long video of a badger talking to children and talking about sight words, and then a little mouse character who does some fun things. That's maybe 8 hours.
Yeah. Look at that, right?
Yeah.
8 hours for 1 minute.
yeah. It's crazy. Although I hold it to a high standard. I try to change everything, every animated video. There's 50 videos, but for the smallest change, I use After Effects. So it's, maybe it's different for most of these other people who you're using real animation software, but wow. Just putting pen to paper can take only a couple of minutes, right? Although Jim Lee's, the auctioned art that he's putting out is incredible. I can't imagine how many hours it's taking him to do each one.
Yeah. I mean, there are a bunch of artists that are working for DC right now where their art is so detailed and so beautiful. I can't imagine either how much labor it takes. That is frustrating. Like, even with the books that I draw myself, I have a really, really pared down style. I have a very simple style, mm-hmm. and even with that simple style, a page fully inked and lettered will take me like 6 to 8 hours to finish. So if you multiply that by, my last book was 400 something pages. It's a good chunk of your life. And I'll get these readers who'll say, "Oh, I read your book in like 2 hours." I'm like, that's like 5 years of my life that you read in 2 hours.
I was going to say, if you like walk into a bookstore and you see someone flipping every like 10 seconds and they're just like scanning the art, they're not even like consuming it, like taking it in. That must like drive you mad.
Yeah. And I think it's even worse with some of the superhero stuff, because the art is so detailed and so lush with for somebody not to pause on every panel feels like a crime.
It's a small little alarm is going off somewhere. Do you remember which Superman comic was the first comic that you got?
It was DC Comics Presents number 57, starring Superman and the Atomic Knights.
Nice.
It was about nuclear war. It was really, really intense story. Yeah. Yeah. The world blows up basically. And there's an apocalyptic storyline all the way through.
How old were you at the time?
I was in fifth grade.
Okay.
I mean, it was the 80s. So everybody was talking about the atomic bomb all the time.
Right.
But to have a Superman comic made it extra, extra intense.
Yeah. You didn't expect it.
No.
Are you reading any comics right now?
I'm a big Mark Russell fan. Mm-hmm. So an issue of his Billionaire Island came out before everything shut down. Have you read that?
He was literally on this podcast last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we talked about Billionaire Island
We hung out once and it was super fun.
He's super nice.
A book festival. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah,
he's
met at Sandy and I think last June.
He's like one of the best or one of the most unique voices writing comics right now.
Oh,
right?
My God. Yes. Like Flintstones is just one of many where there's so much great social commentary.
Yeah. Flintstones was awesome. Second Coming. I recently read Second Coming.
Well, did you know Billionaire Island was like inspired by people like Elon Musk actually buying like bunkers in New Zealand that go down like 50 stories, and they're like master villain Lex Luthor. Yeah, it's crazy. He said there are rich people who have these yachts that can stay at sea for 4 years without ever docking. Like, he was telling us on the show, you should listen to the show. He was telling us all about like how this is not necessarily that far off from reality.
I'm sure they're on those boats right now then, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're probably
all the toilet paper. Separated. They've got it all.
Yeah, with all the toilet paper. That's right. They took all the toilet paper with them. Yeah, so I'm a big Mark Russell fan. Nice. I've also been reading a bunch of books from the DC Comics YA line, you know, the middle grade YA line that Superman Smashes the Clan is a part of. Green Lantern Legacy by Min Lay and Andy Tong is a favorite in our house. I'm actually speaking with him tomorrow on a podcast with Min.
Oh, great.
Shadow the Batgirl is also awesome. And we're big fans of Shannon Hale's Real Friends and Best Friends. Have you read those books?
I haven't. I've read a lot of the DC books, but
yeah, they're middle grade. So those are not DC books. Those are actually first second books. But Shannon Hale also wrote Diana, Princess of the Amazons,
which
is a DC.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I reviewed that one.
Yeah. So that circulated at our house for several weeks, over and over again. The kids would read it over and over again.
Oh, that's awesome. I have to say, the DC Zoom, DC Kids books, even though DC set this interview up, I have to admit they're amazing. They're just so good. Like, I think it's the reading experience, right? Like, you pick it up, you get the whole thing in one sitting.
Yeah. And every book, because they're only loosely tied to continuity, every book does world building. Every book kind of has to immerse you. You know, they can't assume that you know anything about the world before you go in. And I think that actually works in the story's favor. No, I'm a huge fan. Like, even if I were not involved in this line, I would be a huge fan of what they're doing.
Have you read The Runaway Princess? That's a recent release by Penguin.
I have that, but I have not yet read it.
That one is stellar. I could not put it down. It's kind of maybe for a little bit older because there's some scary kind of imagery in there. Although maybe it's just scary to me. I don't know. But Penguin's doing some amazing stuff with the kids graphic novels lately.
Yeah.
Actually, I think it was just their first foray into the industry.
I know. I'm actually, so the lead there is Gina Gagliano, who is at First Second. And she and I are pretty good friends. And I'm a little sad that their first, you know, their debut list is kind of coinciding with what we're going through right now. So I'm hoping that when things open back up again, that they'll get the attention that they deserve because they're putting out some really cool stuff.
Pie in the Sky, what is one character you would like to work on you haven't yet?
Well, I've always liked Robin. You know, and the original one, Dick Grayson, I think he's a really interesting character because he's able to stay happy even though he lives with Bruce Wayne. I think, you know, Bruce Wayne's kind of a psycho, like a sociopath, right?
So yeah.
I
can't be healthy.
I don't know, for a teenager to do his teenagery things, to have gone through the same kind of tragedy, losing his parents, but still be able to maintain a positive outlook on life, I think says something really awesome. And then there are other characters too. There's I love Mr. Miracle. Although after like the recent Tom King miniseries, I don't know if there's anything left to say.
It's hard to follow that too, isn't
but
it?
He's one of my favorites. Like the whole Fourth World universe, I've always loved.
There's a new Jack Kirby collection. I think it's an Absolute collection coming out in a couple months that's featuring a bunch of the New Gods stuff and the Jimmy Olsen, the old Jimmy Olsen comics that I don't think have ever been reprinted. So I'm excited for that.
Oh, cool. I have like some Essential collections where they were done in black and white. I got them, I don't know, a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've always loved them. Like, there's just some really crazy ideas, right? That dude was like...
Oh, yeah.
Every other page had a crazy idea on it.
There are days where I wonder if Jack Kirby had the technology we have now to draw, what would he have come up with? Because you have actually more time to get detailed, right? You have more time to lay out the. I mean, I've been watching some Instagram videos, and it's insane how they can like literally cut Daredevil's hand right off, and then like just rejigger it, move it a little bit so that it looks different. Like Jack Kirby would have died for that, right?
Oh, he would have. I mean, I would be worried that he would go too crazy on the zoom. You know what I mean? Like, he would just zoom in and zoom in and zoom in. And it'd be like detail after detail after detail.
Or even like his mixed media stuff that he did in Fantastic Four here and there, where like,
yeah,
like light stuff over. Yeah, that was pretty intense for the time.
He would have loved it. He would have loved it. He would have loved Procreate and an iPad and an Apple Pencil.
I know we've been talking DC. I have to ask you though, Shang-Chi, I'm so excited. Can you tell us a little bit about your love of the character?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I didn't really have a ton of love of the character before up until recently. So it's like this. This is how I felt about Shang-Chi when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was in fourth grade, and this third grader immigrated from Taiwan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers on yard duty, super well-intentioned, they were really, really into us being friends. They constantly try to put us together to be friends.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I really, really did not want to be this kid's friend because at the time, I still felt kind of weird about how my cultural heritage made me different. And it just felt like if I hung out with this kid, it'd make me feel even more different. It would like highlight the fact that I was different. And that's how I felt about Shang-Chi comics in my local comic book store. Uh-huh. I always felt weird about picking them up because I was like, you know, what are people going to think? A Chinese kid walking around with a Chinese comic.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, now that I've read some of those old Shang-Chi comics, I don't know if I was missing out on too much. There are some really cool aspects of it. I think some of the ways that they portrayed action is cool. But
the espionage stuff too.
His origin story is really rough, dude. You know, at least from a modern perspective, it's really rough.
I recently reviewed one of the new collections that were re-released, and two things. One, I loved like it had like a James Bond kind of feel, and it was like he was also able to fight. But then I hated how yellow they would draw him sometimes.
Yeah,
and
I
can't believe they didn't.
They went crazy on that yellow.
Yeah, if they're gonna re-release it, fix that, guys. Right?
Yeah, they used all the yellow ink on Shang-Chi for sure. Yeah. But I think there are like really interesting aspects about him. You know, like the fact that he is the son of a supervillain, I think can lend itself to a lot of drama. But part of what excites me about this project that I'm doing with Marvel is we get to kind of rework some of those old stories and maybe bring out some nuance.
Right. Yeah, I'm very excited for it. I can't wait for it. I hope it comes out when it's supposed to in June, given all what's going on with COVID-19.
Yeah, things are, I feel like everything's up in the air. It's hard to tell.
It's like day to day, right?
Yeah, it really is.
One last question, Gene. Off topic, top shelf. This is where I ask you what you're into right now that's not comics related.
Ooh, that's not comics related. Well, my wife is Korean American, and we are watching Korean dramas. So we've been watching one called My Hollow Love. Hmm. Hollow meaning hollow being spelled H-O-L-O on Netflix. It's fun. It's about a woman who falls in love with a hologram of a really good-looking Korean man.
Am I sensing you're regretting telling me this?
maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also wonder why my wife is so into that show, right? Like, what is she trying to tell me?
That's funny.
While we're watching this show about a holographic boyfriend.
It's a lesson.
And then I'm just at the beginning of a YA book called Not So Pure and Simple by Lamar Giles.
Hmm.
Which is about purity culture in African American churches, and it's sort of, I think it's a drama, but it does have some comedic elements, for sure.
Nice, very cool. Well, Gene, thank you so much for being on the show. Superman Smashes the Clan comes out May 12th in collect edition at bookstores near you. Thanks again.
All right, thank you. Great to talk to you.